Well, I bring you good news. I have fixed NeoVim. Don't clap, just throw money.
NeoVim, is that a text editor?
Oh no. Not a mere text editor. A full IDE, I will have you know. But, you know, it's got some rough edges, and I've fixed them all, and I'm here to tell you all about it.
Wasn't the point of NeoVim to fix all the rough edges in Vim?
Yes, it was, but it still has rough edges all of its own, and I've fixed them all.
So is this now NeoVim, or is this NeoVim NG, or NeoVim +++? What is this?
Well, there are lots of, get this, NeoVim distributions. I have created a NeoVim configuration, which I call NeoCode, and I will explain why this thing exists. The problem with NeoVim is all of the Vim key bindings and Vim motions, and that's what I fixed. I have made it a sane editor that doesn't trigger your complex PTSD or Stockholm syndrome. So this adheres to strict CUA muscle memory. It is a VS Code-like experience all the way down. It is a modeless editor.
Please, sir, what does CUA mean?
It means common user access. And what that means to the uninitiated is every application you've ever interacted with other than Vim, those are the key bindings. So Control F to find, Shift and navigate to select text, Control C to copy, Control X to cut, Control Y to paste, Control Z to undo. This is all part of CUA, and it was kind of created by IBM, sort of adopted by Microsoft during that sort of Windows OS 2 collaboration era. But it's basically the same way that you use editor-like user interfaces.
I feel like there's an argument with two sets of greybeards here. There's the greybeards who are Vim diehards from the early days of like the VT100 terminal and that kind of that time. And then there's the other set of greybeards who are OS2 fanatics and will not let it lie, right?
Yeah, and there's kind of like Greybeard 2.5, which is where I think I fit, which is depending on which early Unix distribution you used, and therefore which mail client you used, kind of denoted which editor you used, and therefore what you were familiar with. So all through my early Unix days, it was CUA because I used Xenix as one of my very first Unix operating systems, which was made by Microsoft.
So if you are married to these key bindings, why would you start with a Vim-based editor when you want to create your new editing environment?
So this is a very good point, and I think I have a good answer, which is if you want a terminal-based IDE, there is really only one credible place to start, and that is NeoVim. Because if you compare the entire JetBrains suite or VS Code or Zeditor or Sublime and their ecosystem of plugins and language server protocol support and all of that stuff that turns what is a text editor into an IDE, NeoVim is the only game in town for the terminal. Right. And what I wanted was a proper IDE experience in the terminal that didn't traumatize me. So that's what I've made.
Okay. Go on then. Tell us what you've actually done.
So it starts quite simply. There is an existing NeoVim plugin. I think it's either plugin or extensions. I can't remember exactly. And it's called NoVim Mode. And that's where I started, and it gets me most of the way there. So this is what means things like Control C to copy and all of those key bindings that I'm familiar with and Shift and arrow selections to highlight text. It makes all of that work. And I thought I would just have to enable that extension and that would be the end of the whole discussion. But sadly, it's not. Because it kind of makes the basic editor work the way I want mostly. We'll get to that a bit later. But it doesn't have all of the other features of a modern IDE. So then I went hunting around and I got kind of deep into the NeoVim ecosystem. And this is where you learn that whole distributions, like a Linux distribution exists, that presents Linux in a particular way. They are these NeoVim distributions that come with pre-shipped and pre-configured extensions and plugins in order to give you the, you know, in air quotes, best NeoVim experience. And none of them are the best because they all still have Vim motions and Vim key bindings. So we'll just brush over that. But, you know, looking through that, there are hundreds, maybe even thousands of NeoVim plugins and extensions. So I went hunting through them all to recreate what was previously my VS Code experience and is now my Zeditor experience in the terminal. And snacks.nvim does most of the heavy lifting there. It's sort of a mono repo of lots of small plugins and extensions for NeoVim that close the gap on usability in a lot of meaningful ways. So have a nice dashboard, and I have my NeoCode branding when the editor starts with a blank editor. It also has the command palette and a file explorer that you can bring up using the common key bindings you would expect to use in a CUA style editor. And then building on that, there's a whole bunch of additional plugins that I added. And this was kind of a curse and a blessing because there are lots of these extensions and I added lots of them. I think I'm using about 30 or so in total. But the problem is a lot of them kind of expect the default NeoVim experience, right, not what I'm trying to create. So I ended up having to write just a few 1,500 lines of Lua in order to coerce these various extensions and plugins in order to operate in my relentlessly modeless NeoVim experience. So there was lots of Lua wrangling involved in order to turn a Vim style editor into a VS Code style editor. But I did get there.
I've just rummaged around in your GitHub and I have found the Wimpy's Nix config, and I think I've found where this is. I can see about 29 plugins that right. you're adding to NeoVim. I don't know all of them, and I don't particularly care, but like that sounds like quite a lot.
Yes, it is. And it's way more plugins than I would add to my browser. But I think looking back when I did that transition from VS Code to Zeditor, it's about the same amount of extensions I had in VS Code in order to turn that into the IDE that was usable for me.
And given that you'd already done that transition, what is it that you're doing that requires you to have this full-fledged IDE experience in the terminal other than because I can?
So we'll just leave because I can alone. It's mostly because I find myself doing a lot more in the terminal. With the advent of agentic coding and using things like Claude Code and Codex, commonly my new IDE is Claude Code or Codex, and then lazy git open next to it so I can see the code changes as they're developing and steer the agent. And then when things go awry, dropping into a text editor mm-hmm. and cleaning up myself, which I've been using Zed for. But increasingly, I'm using remote workstations as the place where this happens because right. we use these large Google-hosted workstations at work and a graphical user interface is not your friend there. So what I wanted to do is have the full IDE experience through a terminal that I can SSH to that gives me something like Zed or VS Code, but purely text-based. So that was kind of my motivation.
So I've done this the other way around, where I've had remote machines, but I've used VS Code on my workstation and over SSH mounted the remote end, and it means that I've got a, in inverted commas, proper graphical IDE, and then the built-in terminal at the bottom of the code editor that they all have. And this isn't just VS Code, they all have this, right? The terminal at the bottom happens to turn into a terminal at the other end. And so you can run whatever that agent or whatever AI nonsense is going on in there and then still see what's going on in the IDE. Is that not good enough, like, given that you're a real, like, Z/VS Code person? Or do you still feel, like, closer to the machine or something if you do it in a terminal?
Yeah, because I'm logged in over SSH to these remote workstations, right, and I'm already running processes in them over SSH, just being able to quit out of lazy git and start up NeoCode means that I can just quickly go in and ninja the things that I need to change, as opposed to doing, you know, all of those clever things you can do with, you know, the modern day IDEs. It just felt a better fit and it felt more immediate, and it was a matter of mere months in order to create this thing. I mean, how easy could it have been? And you mentioned the opening a terminal up and all the rest of it. That's one of the 30 plugins right there.
Wait, what? You're SSH'd in and you're in a text editor and then you shell out to a... Okay.
The bottom pane with a terminal editor, you know, terminal beneath it, you know, because, well, that's how you do it, right? Like, you don't want to change your habits. You want to adapt the tooling around your sort of expectations.
And is this something you would only see as Martin's weird configuration that he uses and doesn't have value to anyone else, and therefore no one's going to want a copy of this packaged up or something? Or are you going to make this a thing?
I am definitely not going to make this a thing. I am sure there must be people out there somewhere that make a distribution that does this sort of stuff. This is very idiosyncratic.
You're self-aware, if nothing else, Martin. I'll give you that.
But it is kind of beautiful, and it is a testament to just how flexible NeoCode is as an engine. Let's just call it an engine, right? It's infinitely adaptable. I mean, one of the things is, you know, in most NeoVim editors, you will see a thing in the status bar that tells you whether you're in insert mode or not. Well, that just doesn't even appear in my... I've just patched that out entirely. It's irrelevant because you're always in insert mode. That is the only mode. It's the only mode that exists. But patching around, or monkey patching around, the various plugins that expect to be able to transition between modes, because even things like file pickers and what have you are aware that, you know, you can be in different modes. So, you know, changing their behavior to just expect that, actually, no, I don't want HJKL as my, you know, navigation keys. I want the cursor keys. And also, the reason why this is idiosyncratic is, I've mentioned before on this podcast a little bit, but maybe others, my right hand is very badly damaged. I have lots of nerve damage in my right hand.
No, you were right time.
Yeah, I think maybe I was. We'll leave that in. I have lots of nerd... nerve damage in my right hand. So actually keeping those fingers on the keyboard row isn't to my benefit at all, because it's painful and uncomfortable. So that is another kind of reason why I made this, because it gets me away. I'm left-handed as well, so it moves, you know, my hands to more comfortable places on the keyboard. But, you know, this was an interesting experiment. It's worked out very well for me. There are a couple of downsides, but, you know, not that many. It generally sort of works. But in the not too distant future, I will be presenting something that is better than this.
No new games that I've wanted to buy have come out in a while, and this has given me an opportunity to go through the backlog of games on my Steam wish list and try some which have been hanging around for a while, but I never got around to playing. And the latest one I picked up is Solasta, Crown of the Magister.
So, on your wish list, or things that you've bought that you've never played?
No, these are things I put on my wish list thinking, oh, I'd probably quite like to play that. But then other things have come out and I've thought straight away, oh, I have to get that now. And so these things have just sat there for a while. And then occasionally they'll come up on sale, because Steam tells you when something on your wish list's on sale. And I've been picking those off more recently.
When you buy things that are on sale, do you stick to a rule? Like, I know some people will say, you know, never buy it when it's 25% off because at some point it'll be like 90% off or something like that. Or do you just like, oh, there's a sale, I've got a bit of cash, I've got a gap in my schedule to play a game, I'll buy that.
Yeah, basically, like, yeah,
right.
Am I ready to play this game? Is it at a price that I'm willing to pay? If both of those answers are yes, then I don't go through the price history and say, is that the cheapest it's ever been or anything like that.
Got it.
So how long has this been sitting in your wish list?
Oh, I mean, it's been around a while. I think it, so the game that I'm going to compare it to, slightly unfairly, but because it's a good basis for comparison, is Baldur's Gate 3. And I think it came out before Baldur's Gate 3, which is a couple of years ago now, I think.
So the release date for the game you're about to talk about is 27th of May, 2021, according to Steam.
Yes. So it's been around about 5 years now. And the sequel is in development or early release now, which is another reason I thought it would be a good time to pick this up and have a look.
You're such an advanced, like, chooser of games to play. So the question really remains is, Alan, are you going to ask or am I going to ask?
Oh, no. I'm just assuming it's a given now.
No, it doesn't.
Oh, okay. Good. Carry on.
So as I mentioned, well, no, it's not that kind of game. As I mentioned, a good basis of comparison is Baldur's Gate 3. It's a computer RPG, party-based. And it is based on the Dungeons & Dragons rule set. But unlike Baldur's Gate 3, it's not an official branded Dungeons & Dragons game. There's actually a Creative Commons edition of the Dungeons & Dragons rule set called the System Reference Document, I think it's called.
Brilliant.
So if you want to make your own content for people who play Dungeons & Dragons, you can get this and make something which is going to be compatible with all the systems. And they've done that and made a whole computer RPG around it.
I'm nodding along like that's a good thing, and I'm sure it is, but I have no idea what any of that meant. But compatibility, we're all about that. That sounds good.
Yeah. I mean, what it means ultimately is it's a game where you have a party of adventurers and you roll many-sided dice to determine the outcome of things that go on. And I mentioned this when I discussed playing Baldur's Gate 3. It does a lot of the same things in that regard to make you feel like you're playing a Dungeons & Dragons game. So when there's some sort of check of your abilities going on, it doesn't just do it and then say whether it passed or failed. You actually see on screen the dice rolls involved and you get an idea of the probabilities of things going well or not. And, you know, you get that sort of tactile board game feel, even though it's all on the computer, which is quite nice. And I've been playing for a fair bit now, going through mostly the main quest. There's sort of the main quest and little offshoots, not as much as some of the other of these sorts of games I've played so far, but I'm not yet sure what the whole scope of the game is. So there might be more to it than I'm realizing. And basically, the way I can succinctly describe it is it's like Baldur's Gate 3's nerdier indie cousin.
Nerdier.
Yeah.
I feel like 1,000 people's ears just pricked up.
So I think Baldur's Gate 3 did a really good job of making a really fiddly, intricate system of doing battles and things like that into a really accessible, attractive, mass market thing. You wouldn't have thought a game that uses that kind of turn-based battle system would be as much of a smash as it was. But to do that, they did some work, put some polish on it. And Celasta kind of strips away that polish a bit and goes back to the more raw, nerdy version of it. And I quite like that.
When you say nerdy, are you thinking like the human has to, you know, conjure formulas and do things manually? Is that the kind of nerd, or has to have an encyclopedic knowledge of lore and stuff? Or in what way is it nerdy?
It's not quite to that extent. You don't have to have like knowledge beyond what the game is showing you, but there's a lot more that the game shows you which you need to take into account. So things like, where are the sources of light in the scene, and therefore which monsters can you see well and which can you not see well? And what is the vertical position of a character in the scene? And the fact that when you fly, you don't just fly, that doesn't just allow you to move between two platforms, it actually allows you to move to a space in midair if you want to and stay there, and then that affects your distance from people and so on. So having all of this other stuff to take into account, I imagine it's not for everyone, but having had the introduction to that slightly lower level of detail with Baldur's Gate 3, having that extra level exposed, I'm finding quite fun.
So not so much nerdy, I would say more technical. Is it more technical? Is that fair?
Yes, I'd say that's fair. More technical.
And as we have a majority of Linux listeners, I imagine you are playing this on the original Steam Deck that you own, and the performance is just fine?
Yes, performance is just fine. It's not massively graphically demanding. It's, you know, like sort of bird's eye view of a scene. It's not like a first person rich environment all around you, although the scenes are quite rich, nicely well drawn, but it's mostly just sort of static background stuff, so it's not hugely graphically demanding. There are scenes with, you know, dialogue scenes with characters, 3D characters, which could look better, probably would on higher graphic settings, but it'll do for the purposes of the dialogue, which is one of the bits, let's say, that doesn't come across quite as well as something
part.
The dialogue part is a bit lackluster in places compared to other games. I'm not just going to say Baldur's Gate 3, and that's an unfair comparison because it's obviously a game with a much bigger team and a much bigger budget, but perhaps comparing to something like Pillars of Eternity, which is another indie game in this genre, some of it, there's a bit of a weird disconnect when you're having a conversation between the option that you pick to say, what your character says out loud, and what the subtitle says they said can often be quite different things.
And my experience of games of this genre, which is not my like first choice, is these are games I play rarely, is that you often have to scatter around the keyboard, a bit like NeoVim, in order to do various things. So how does that translate to a Steam Deck sort of experience?
So they've done a reasonably good job with that in terms of you get all the... Well, there's sort of two menus which you summon with the triggers, which are like ring menus. So that's what you do for switching characters and going into your inventory or your journal or other things, which are generally like hotkeys on a keyboard. And then when you're picking things to do, you basically have a display on screen which you move around with your analog stick or your arrows and then press a button to select the thing that you want to do. And it has all the prompts on screen for which button does what, which works fairly well. There's a few oddities whereby sometimes you can't do things, but it doesn't really tell you why you can't do things. There's an additional layer of spell casting stuff where a character can cast spells, but some spells you have to have a free hand in order to cast certain spells, and you have to be able to speak in order to cast certain spells, and you have to have a thing called a spell focus. And so sometimes you'll open your menu to cast a spell and none of your spells will be available and you won't know why, which, you know, that could have been more helpful. But once you understand why, having read up on it on the internet, at least you can work that out.
When I opened the Steam page while we're recording this, it shows at the top of the Steam page a live stream of someone playing it right now. And it's quite an appealing user interface in that you get a, like you say, a bird's eye view of the play area, the dungeon or whatever it is. And yeah, you can see the light sources. So it's line of sight and you can see a lot of detail around your characters, where they are. And as you select them, it draws like a grid of all of the places that character has enough, what, movement points or what action points or whatever they are to get to. And then as you draw towards something, it draws a little line through of the path that character will take, which actually reminds me of some like super old like games like Syndicate. I was thinking more of, well, yes, that kind of like from long, long distant past. It's actually surprisingly familiar to me, even though I don't play these kind of games. It looks like something I could probably pick up.
Yeah, and it's quite kind to you as well, because when you're doing that sort of thing, there might be like there's a mechanic in Dungeons and Dragons where if you're standing next to an enemy, you're engaged with them, and then if you move away from them, they can attack you for free, and it will show you if anything you're going to do would trigger that, including if you're taking a path which goes too close to another enemy, and then you might want to go a different way around, or if you're in stealth anywhere that you might stand, which would make someone instantly see you. And if there's something that happens in the battle and you're able to do a reaction to that immediately, it will prompt you and give you the choices. So you don't have to think, oh no, I need to mash that button now before I lose my chance. It's you know, it holds your hand a bit and makes sure that it's not trying to catch you out with all of these interesting things that can happen.
Okay, so it shows you those consequences visually, unlike something like the early Zelda games where you had to know that those were the consequences of your actions if you stepped too close to an object or an enemy.
Yeah, and I was thinking less of Syndicate, more of UFO. The Julian Gollop kind of games, mm-hmm. where the other similar line of sight, and you know, the lighting was very terrible because it was back in the day. But it was, yes, and the characters had opportunity fire. So yes, if you happened to walk near them and they had any action points left, they could take a shot at you as you happened to walk past. But you didn't know they were going to do that because you can't see them. So this sounds quite forgiving for someone like myself who hasn't played. Is this the kind of game that like someone who hasn't played a D&D game, like? Last time we talked about games, you talked about a Star Trek game. For people who haven't played Star Trek games, that sounded to me like a good entry point into the Star Trek universe. Is this a good starting point, or should someone have experience of other games before they try this one?
I mean, I wouldn't have thought you'd need experience specifically of D&D, but maybe of other computer RPGs, just because it's quite detailed. You might want something that's a bit less detailed first before you go in for this. One other system I do want to mention, because I find it particularly pleasing, is that when you're moving between the main areas of the game, most other games in this genre which I've played don't actually have any kind of travel system. You just say, it gives you a world map and you say, I'm in this town and I need to go to that forest, and you click there and you get a loading screen and you're there. Whereas this actually has a travel system where you have to say, you know, how fast you're going to be, check you've got enough resources, and say how many times you're going to make camp. And you, each time you make camp, you might get ambushed or you might spot an ambush, and then you have to have a fight. And those fights are quite useful because you always rest afterwards. So they give you an opportunity to use all of your things and try everything out, which you might not always want to do. Like, so if you just leveled up and got some new spells, you can fire all of those spells in one battle and see what they do. And then you get to have a rest straight afterwards. And then you get them all back for when you're where you actually travel to, and then you know what you're doing. So I think the inclusion of that is a really nice addition to this.
Back in 2022, I made a thing called Unsnap, which was mostly a silly joke that people took a little bit too seriously because I used to work for Canonical, and clearly this is a swipe at Canonical. And the goal of it was to make a simple system for people to remove a snap and replace it by a flat pack of the same name. That was the premise of the thing. And like I say, it was a bit of a joke. It's mostly abandoned. That was a thing that happened in the past.
Like most of your meme-y software, though, it did very well. I mean, it did the rounds, right? It got a lot of coverage. You have a habit of building tools like this, because I remember Susumi, which was your Mac OS in a snap project, which kind of informed QuickEmu, ultimately. And that did the rounds on some very large YouTube channels like Snazzy Labs. So you sort of have a habit of sort of honing in on the zeitgeist of what people are looking for.
You're very kind. Okay. It's got like 1,000 stars, this Unsnap thing, which is, yes, a bit silly. I think Susumi? I think I've archived that. So that's got, I don't know where that went. I can't tell you how many stars that got. That's the only measure that I need. Is how many stars has it got? Yeah, that was a bit of a joke. Let's not take that too seriously. But I wanted, you probably are aware that Ubuntu ships, all of the Ubuntu flavors ship with Snap by default and Deb as the package managers for installing software. And they don't ship Flatpak by default. And that's okay, because Fedora doesn't ship with Snap by default. And so it makes total sense. Like, you make a distribution, you make some opinionated choices, that has always been the way. And no matter how much people complain, that is not going to change, right? Because those are your opinionated choices for the thing you've built, right? And if you want to build something else, go and build something else. Yes. What I've noticed, though, is that there are some people in the community who would like Ubuntu, but they also want Flatpak to be easy to use on Ubuntu. And so I thought, well, what's the best way to do that? The best way to do that is to make it easier to install Flatpak. Now, installing Flatpak is documented. There are web pages telling you how to do that. It's not actually that hard. But for some people, it's an unsurmountable set of arcane things that you type into a terminal and have no idea whether they're going to completely hose your system or not. And so what I wanted to do was automate the typing of those commands in your terminal for you while making sure they don't hose your system, or trying to at least. So what I thought was, how can we make it easier to add Flatpak support to Ubuntu, given that Ubuntu won't add the capability built in, right? And so what's the easiest way to do this? And I thought, well, the easiest way is with a Snap, because the Snap store is the app store that is built into Ubuntu. And so if the Snap store is there, why don't we put a Snap in the Snap store that makes it easier to add Flatpak support? That's the idea, the genesis of this idea.
Now, hold on a minute.
What?
Well, if you have Flatpak in a Snap, then are you installing Flatpaks inside the Snap? Can a Snap do that?
No, and no. And so that's not what I do. So what I wanted to do was just make it easier to get Flatpak support in the way that Flatpak would support it, and in a way that is the way you would do it anyway. So all I'm doing is making a wrapper around the three or four terminal commands that you would run. That's it, right? That's all I want to do. Now, I call this thing Add Flatpak, and I started work on this, I think, 2 years ago. I had the idea to do this, and I Snapcraft registered Add Flatpak, Add-Flatpak. And I had to fill in a form on the Snapcraft website saying why I want this name registered in the store. And I put exactly why I wanted the name registered. And I started prototyping it. And I started prototyping it as a shell script. Now, you have already alluded to the problem here. And the problem is that snaps are confined. And I do not think in a month of Sundays I would get approval for a classic unconfined snap whose sole purpose was to add Flatpak support. I would not get approval for that.
Yes. And indeed, to run a shell script as root in general isn't really what you want snaps doing.
Fair. I mean, I could point out that the Steam snap is quite unconfined, and at the root of that is a shell script. But let's park that. Right. So, yes, that is the case. And so I thought, well, how could you do this? And so what I've done is I wrote, my prototype was a shell script which detects whether it is a snap running inside a snap confinement or not. And if it is running inside a snap confinement, it copies itself onto the desktop and then tells you, run that shell script. And by doing that, you are running something that is not confined by snap confinement, the version that's on the desktop. And that then is exactly the same shell script, but this time it detects, oh, I'm not a snap anymore. I can do what I need to do. Now, I'm telling the human to do this. I am not copying something onto the desktop and then running it, because you can't do that. I would expect that to be rejected from the store very quickly. So I'm trying to do this in a way that is respectful of the store guidelines, but is useful to an end user. And so I split this into a two-stage process. You install the snap, run the snap, and then do what it tells you to do, which is double-click the thing on the desktop. It then tells you, I'm going to do these things, which are going to enable Flatpak support. Do you want me to do that? If you say yes, it does that, and then it cleans up after itself as well. Because once you've got Flatpak support, you no longer need the add Flatpak snap. Mm-hmm. And so it removes itself afterwards because it can do that because it's on the outside of the snap.
So unlike unsnap, this doesn't try to convert existing snaps to
not
Flatpaks. Okay. And once add Flatpak has done its thing, how do you then access the installation of Flatpaks? Is there a store that is now magically available to you or something?
I'm glad you asked. Yes. So there is a plugin for GNOME software. Now, GNOME software is an app store that used to be shipped in Ubuntu, and there always has been a plugin for that, or has been for a long time, a plugin for that, which enables Flatpak support. So if you do the apt install Flatpak and then Flatpak add remote reference for FlatHub, so there's a pool of Flatpaks you can pull from, and then you add the GNOME software Flatpak plugin, when you launch GNOME software, you have a graphical storefront, just like you have the Snap Store. So now you've got, unfortunately, this is the way it is, two storefronts. One for all your supported by Canonical, supported by the Ubuntu community snaps, and another one for all your Flatpaks. That's what you would end up with. That's the goal. Does that make sense?
It does.
No, it doesn't, because ideally you would have one app store and it would just work, right? And it doesn't make sense, but that's where we are, right? And we're dealing with that. Now, I made that like a couple of years ago, and I left it sitting there baking. And then I've now iterated and thought, I don't really want this to be a shell script. I want it to be a graphical application. So I ported it to Go. And now it is a single Go binary in a snap package called add Flatpak. And what it does is it puts a icon on your desktop when you run it. And what that icon does is launches add Flatpak from outside. So it looks a lot more friendly because you just double click it because it's just an icon on your desktop. And it presents a graphical UI. Now, this was a challenge in itself because I've got this graphical thing inside a snap, and that's easy to configure. That's a known thing. But now I've got this graphical, this binary that's sat on the desktop. And do I have all the libraries necessary for that to launch properly? And I tried to do something as minimal as possible. It's not Electron or anything like that. It's Go and a library called Fyne, F-Y-N-E.
Oh, yeah.
Very
yeah.
basic, very simple UI. It's not pretty right now. I'm hoping to pretty it up before I put it in the store. Now, we're recording this on the 21st of May, and it's not currently in the store, but I do plan to pretty this up and put it in the store the day that this episode goes out in a few weeks. And I'd love people to try it out. I want to test it on a bunch of different releases because the goal is for this to run on any release of Ubuntu. And it's only really targeting Ubuntu users. I don't care if someone on some other distro doesn't have support for Flatpak. This is only targeting Ubuntu users and actually detects whether it's running on Ubuntu or not and refuses to do anything if it's not Ubuntu, because I don't want to break anyone's like Red Hat system or like something else if they happen to install it. But that's where I am at the moment.
This is another brilliant use of Go, because this is it's better than a shell script, but also that ramming things into Go's single execution environment is just delicious. This is why all of those recent tools I've built for the podcast are in Go, because you can make all sorts of decisions about what I just want to ship in this one thing. It's fantastic. And Fyne is brilliant, right? It kind of gives you some of those primitives, things like Zenity and Yad exposed to a shell script, but it's baked into the binary, so you don't have to worry about ATK or Qt or GTK or any of that stuff. It's just there.
One other thing that I do want to make sure works is detecting if you're running in Ubuntu, in GNOME or KDE, because KDE has its own storefront, which is called Plasma Discover, and there is a backend for that Flatpak. And so I want to be able to say, you're running GNOME, here's a thing you could do. But what I've made it do is have little checkboxes and say, here are the things that I plan to do, and you can uncheck them if you don't want them to happen. I want it to be configurable, but I just want to hide and mask away all those horrible command line things, because there's a lot of people that is hard and difficult, you know, cognitively for them to deal with. So I want to make it as easy as possible.
You know what this reminds me of a bit? Automatics.
Hush your filthy mouth. Wow, there's a name I haven't heard for a long time.
It's a bit of a slur as well.
Yeah, for those who aren't familiar in our listeners, Automatics was a shell script, wasn't it?
It gave you a little GUI with a list of checkboxes for the ways you wanted to break the system.
I think at one point Michael Dell blogged about it and wrote about how amazing Automatics is, and everyone flipped out completely because it had the potential to break your system. Yes, I think Matthew Garrett wrote a blog post about it. There's a lot. If you want a deep dive down a rabbit hole, see if you can unarchive some stuff about it. It's nothing like that, Mark. How outrageous slur. I'm putting a lot of checks and balances in here to make sure that it can't do anything like that. It has a very limited set of functionality. There's no way I want this to do anything beyond adding Flatpak support. That's what it's for.
So I've got one suggestion for you, which is don't present that list of options of what you want to do to users by default. Stick that behind some kind of advanced mode, pop out, fold out, or whatever. Just make the right recommended decisions so that if you next finish, you get the right outcome. And it's only if you're a colossal Arch Linux nerd that you know you want to turn on Discover or turn off Discover support.
But it won't run on Arch Linux, so...
That's the idea. Actually, one of the goals is it just doesn't even try on systems that are not compatible. Like, if it hasn't got apt and you're not running Ubuntu, then it should fail. But I plan to do a lot more testing in different versions, probably firing up a VM of lots of different things to make sure it works like reliably. And that's going to be a challenge, especially for the GUI stack and whether the binary is built against one libc or another. I might have to build it against an older libc or something to get it to launch or something.
So are you going to be putting that call to action out in linuxmatters.sh/telegram, where we have nearly 1,000 Linux users hanging out and chatting to us every day?
I will, but I will only do that just before this episode comes out, because I don't want it to get picked up by any silly news articles before people hear from the horse's mouth this episode that you, dear listener, are privileged to hear.